Welcome to the CoinGecko podcast. I'm your host, Bobby Young. Each week, we'll be interviewing someone from the blockchain industry to learn more about this fast-moving cryptocurrency economy. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. The CoinGecko podcast is produced each week to help you stay ahead of the curve. Show notes can be found at podcast.coingecko.com. I highly encourage you to join our newsletter where we send out top news in the crypto industry every Monday to Friday. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter and Telegram at CoinGecko. Welcome to the CoinGecko podcast. For today's episode, we would love to welcome Seth Melamed, COO at Liquid Exchange. Liquid is one of the earliest regulated crypto exchanges, having received its license from the Japanese Financial Sector Agency in 2017. It also conducted one of the largest ICOs in Asia, raising over $100 million for the cash token. It would be great to hear the insights from Seth on the challenges in growing Liquid. So Seth has a very vast experience in finance and operation. He has over 20 years experience in banking, including 11 years of operations at Goldman Sachs as a senior VP of operations. He's been working with Liquid for the past 3 years and has an intimate knowledge of operations, payment, and custody of cryptographic assets. Welcome to the show, Seth.
Thanks very much for having me, Bobby. I'm a big fan of CoinGecko and really glad we can have this opportunity to discuss the industry and what's going on in Japan and at Liquid.
Yeah, looking forward to conversing with you. So for the first question, right, maybe can you tell us a little bit about yourself? How do you get into the blockchain industry and how do you end up as a COO for Liquid?
So my journey, I think, is kind of interesting. I first started getting into Bitcoin and blockchain around 2014. What happened was I was working at a very large international bank, Goldman Sachs, at the time, and I had been working in our Moscow office managing our treasury. And around 2014, there was, a global international incident where there was an invasion of Crimea and a skirmish between Ukraine and Russia. And as a result, there was sanctions on the West placed on Russia. And what happened was our business, in terms of how much activity was going on with our clients, I really slowed down. So I found myself with a lot more free time on my hands. And believe it or not, I actually used that time to stumble across the Satoshi Nakamoto white paper, and I started learning about Bitcoin. So, you know, I read the white paper. I was really interested, especially someone who had spent my entire career working in banking. I was really interested in decentralization, lack of intermediaries, immutable transactions, peer-to-peer payments, of course. And I then started attending conferences at this time, 2014, 15. And at the time, I think the industry was in a very different state. The conferences would generally be about 15 to 20 people. People would get their chairs and their desks and they put them together in a ring. And people would actually make presentations about their projects. And at that time, people actually would sit, listen, take notes, or at least I was, and go back and think about what was going on with innovation and blockchain at the time. So that's how I got started. I bought my first Bitcoin back then. I think I paid around $250, and I thought it was a lot of money, but in hindsight, we're all much smarter than we are today. And started getting involved with Ethereum. I sent my first transaction on Bitcoin around 2014, and I was hooked pretty early on.
That's good. That's good to hear. And tell us more about Liquid then. Like, how did you get started? I don't think you with Liquid from the start, I guess. And then, like, how big is the Liquid team these days?
Sure. So I joined Liquid in 2017. It's been about 3 years now. But I've known one of the co-founders of Liquid since the late 1990s. Will give people an idea how old I actually am. We were working together and here in Tokyo, actually. I actually moved back to New York and changed my jobs a few times, so we stayed close. And in 2015, I went to visit what was then the main Liquid office in Vietnam, which was actually a one-bedroom apartment in District 2, consisting of about four engineers at the time. And I spent the winter vacation over New Year's there and really started learning a lot about the team, Liquid, blockchain. And, you know, so when I went back to work, I gradually got more and more involved, where I was spending more of my time learning about the technology and started to help out Liquid here and there. But then I finally decided in 2017, with my wife 7 months pregnant, to quit my job at a big bank and move here to Tokyo, Japan, and I started heading up the operations team.
That was a big move, like quitting a job when your wife's 7 months pregnant. She must give you a hearing, I suppose.
It was tough. It was also tough to explain it to my parents because they still don't really understand what cryptocurrency is, despite my best efforts to explain it. But today, Liquid is about 150 people. Our headquarters are here in Japan, in Tokyo. Our main development center is in Saigon, in Vietnam. And we also have a team in Singapore that's working on a couple of our key strategic projects, as well as helping to focus on our licensing efforts in Singapore. So we've seen a roller coaster since I joined. I think when I joined, I was probably employee number 40, give or take, or in the 50s around that. We then at some point, I think at our height, got up to over 300 employees. And now we've gone back to around 150, which is probably roughly around the right size. Of course, we think we're really excited about where we are in terms of our growth path. And yeah, it's been really interesting from the ICO time. So, you know, I think Liquid, or at the time we were called Coin, we were one of those big ICOs in the 2017 era. I joined the company right before the ICO, and it was pretty amazing period of time. But, you know, I think a lot of that era has worn off, and now it's much more focused about building products that people actually need and use. And that's where we are today.
Yeah, that's the important thing, right? We want people to build things that is needed in the industry, not speculation with ICO and how much money they can make. It was crazy times back in 2017, 2018. So you guys are based in Japan. You guys have a license with the Japanese Financial Sector Agency. How is it like operating in a regulated blockchain space in Japan? Would you say it is tough? There's a lot of rules and regulations put in place by the Japanese FSA. Would you say they are onerous? Yeah, I just want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, it's a mixed story, right? So regulations comes with it a lot of responsibilities. The licenses, of course, it's a big effort to get a license, but it's not just getting the license, maintaining it. So if I look at some of my peers and other exchanges that are not dealing with the licensing regime, it may be hard for them to understand that we have, you know, at least 5 different compliance officers, senior compliance officers, and then several junior officers. We have a team of lawyers. I think we're at about 4 or 5 lawyers at this point. And we have constant dialogue with our regulator here in Japan. I myself, I'll visit with the JFSA from time to time. We definitely have a lot of interaction with the industry working group. So there's definitely burdens in terms of reporting, but I also look at it as helping to provide good governance and a good framework for growing blockchain as a viable means of storing and transferring value. So one good example of why I think the regulations are important is cryptocurrency exchanges in Japan have to maintain a segregation of client assets. And we actually, at this stage, are reporting to the regulators pretty much on a daily basis and demonstrating that client assets are in segregated wallets on the crypto side and in segregated bank accounts on the fiat side. And this is the type of investor protections that, you know, are really standard in traditional fiat or banking world. And you can start to see that this sort of investor protections are starting to emerge in the crypto space. And I think that's overall a healthy thing. It will bring more confidence to institutions and corporates who might not otherwise feel comfortable leaving their assets with unregulated entities where they don't know if there is a good protection of the institution that they left their assets with.
What do you think about the crypto exchange landscape in Japan? Last time I count, there was about 21 crypto exchanges in Japan, and some of them are operated by some of the largest companies, such as Yahoo Japan.
It's incredibly competitive. I think a lot of the larger companies here, internet-based companies like Rakuten, DMM, GMO, where they're looking for ways to grow their existing businesses, and obviously crypto has definitely been one of them. So they've invested a significant amount of resources to create their own cryptocurrency exchanges. When the licensing first came out, we were the, you know, one of the first handful of 7 licensees. And like you mentioned, today there's 21. And what's interesting is even at 21, there's still a waiting list of applicants to receive their exchange license in Japan. And it's really tough, right? We're often facing very well capitalized exchanges that are usually part of a much larger group with securities divisions or large internet division. But, you know, in some ways, we turn that as an inspiration for ourselves to really work even harder. You know, despite this large competition that we face, Liquid has done a great job of maintaining our market-leading position. So if you look at the trade data published today, you'll see that Liquid is representing between 60 to 70% of all BTC JPY trading activity. And we've been able to maintain that market-leading position for several years now. So we're still basically larger than the rest of the entire market combined, at least in BTC JPY. And that comes about through a lot of hard work and collaboration, listening to our clients, the management team, myself included. We set some KPIs to meet with at least three clients per week to get their feedback about the platform. And I sit through quite a bit of market analysis of where we need to improve Liquid. And those are the things we've been doing to keep our position and hopefully will help us to grow the new products that we think will help us get to the next stage of our growth.
I think what you say is very interesting. The senior management at Liquid have a KPI of meeting three clients per week. It shows that you guys take things seriously and you want to know what the clients want and really meet them and get feedback on what needs to be improved. So quite rare to hear that senior management having KPI of meeting three clients a week. So kudos on you guys for that. Yeah. One of the common complaints I always hear from Japanese traders is that it's really hard to trade altcoins because each altcoin needs to be approved by the Japanese FSA before it can be added by a Japanese exchange. Do you think that's true? Like the Japanese FSA makes it hard to trade altcoins and that's kind of bad in general? Or do you think that's a good move because you kind of filter off all the shit coins and you only get the top coins that's allowed to be traded by the Japanese traders?
So I think the way to think about this problem is really understand what the mandate is of the JFSA. They have two main mandates. One is to make sure that consumers are not hurt by the financial institutions that are providing services to them. And they do have a whitelisting process here in Japan. And there's actually several layers of due diligence. I think we would call it from an exchange standpoint due diligence, but they call it a questionnaire and a survey, where essentially it's the same thing, where they're trying to understand the rationale for the token, trying to, of course, filter out the scams and sort of tokens that don't really have a utility, and ask questions about the soundness of the technical architecture. They go into the backgrounds of the team. They look at things like the number of actual utility for the tokens, the amount of development resources that are used, the way the funds were raised for the project. And so these are all the factors that go into the FSA's decision whether the token can be whitelisted in Japan. Now, a little bit into the Japan exchange history, it's had a big problem with hacks, right? So at a certain point, if we go way back into 2014, of course, we had one of the biggest hacks of all time in Japan with Mt. Gox. The regulators actually turned that into a positive by deciding, well, we're going to regulate this industry to help bring control so consumers are not hurt by this sort of hack and lack of controls and security for consumers. The second sort of mandate for the FSA is that they have visibility about what's going on among the licensed institutions. So part of that is understanding the nature of the assets that the exchanges are listing. In some ways, it's very similar to a new share that's being listed on a stock exchange. The regulators require that an exchange does a certain level of due diligence. The bankers underwriting it have done their due diligence. And they're basically applying those principles of transparency and investor protections to a cryptocurrency setting. So under that vein, I definitely understand it. I think we can take issue with maybe the rate of approval for new tokens. It's been very slow. So the comment that the trader that it's hard to trade altcoins is 100% correct. Right? I think this year, 2020 year to date, there might have been two or three new altcoins that were listed in Japan. And so it is not easy. It takes a lot of back and forth with both the self-regulatory organization and the regulator, the JFSA, in order to get approval to list a new token. Here at Liquid, we hope to do that as well, but we have a lot of challenges and integrate and really dialogue with the JFSA that needs to happen before we can start listing new tokens.
can I understand, like, for liquids focus? I mean, I went to liquid.com. There's so many coins that are listed for trading there. I believe most of these coins are not allowed to be traded in Japanese. So I believe there's probably two interfaces, one for the Japanese users and then one for the international users. What's liquids focus? Is it growth in the regulated Japanese marketplace or growth in the more non-regulated international market?
Yeah, it's a great question. We think that we have a very special situation here at Liquid, that we're really the only exchange in Japan that's serving both global markets as well as the Japanese market. Where I spend my time, it's really almost half and half, right? In terms of segregation of assets, we've developed our infrastructure such that based on your country of residence, the assets that you have access to and the order books that you have access to are different. So for our clients on our Liquid Japan platform, they're only able to see the whitelisted tokens. There's five cryptos and fiat, of course, versus our global platform. They can trade a broad range of digital assets. I think we're somewhere over 100 different cryptocurrencies listed on Liquid Global today.
Let's get to your ICO, your exchange token, Cash. So Cash was one of the earliest exchange tokens launched back in 2017. You guys raised a big round, $100 million in your ICO during the bull times. However, from my point of view, it seems that development of Cash seems to have been slow relative to the other exchange tokens. What are some of the utility of Cash these days? Is it discounted trading from your Liquid? Are there any token burns based on exchange revenue or profits? And then also, what's the plans for increasing utility for Cash in the future?
Sure. It's a fair point. I think the first thing is we need to be completely honest and transparent that we haven't delivered on a lot of the promises and goals that we had set out when we had done our Cash ICO in 2017. I don't think we're alone in that vein, but certainly we have to recognize that we have not developed the Cash utility to the extent that we need to. In terms of what you can do with it today, there is utility. Today, when you use Cash as a method of paying the trade fees, you get 50% off the trade fees from trading on Liquid. So we've seen that that's been helpful, and we see that a fairly healthy percentage of the users on Liquid are actually using Cash to pay for the trade fees and reduce their costs, which is great, but it's certainly not enough. And the price from the ICO reflects that there's more work to do. Rather than getting into all the specifics of what we're going to be doing, I think what I'll leave it as, the way we really think about this in two ways. Number one, we've appointed a member of our management team, Kai Kono, to become the Chief Token Development Officer, where he has a clear mandate to develop the Cash utility and, you know, create scarcity and create demand for the token by various new products that we're rolling out with new partnerships that we're developing. And the second main point is that the management team still is compensated with Cash as part of our compensation, so that what people need to know is that we're equally aligned and motivated to improve the performance of Cash and increase the utility of Cash such that we ourselves will benefit from that as well as our community.
That's good to hear. And then I was reading a white paper a few days back, and one of the initiatives, at least in the white paper, was to launch a Cash blockchain by Q2 2019. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, is that still in the works? And what do you think would be the use of a Cash blockchain? We have seen several exchanges taking this route, the most obvious one being Binance with their Binance chain, and then now they have an EVM compatible chain as well. Huobi talk a lot about their Huobi chain that they plan to launch this year. OK is in testnet already with the OK chain. But I'm not really convinced if an exchange should really have its own chain. I don't see the point of an exchange running and own a blockchain. And if all exchanges run their own chain, we come back to a situation where things don't talk to each other again. Yeah, I just want to hear your thoughts. Like, do you think exchanges should run a chain?
So I'm an old school banker, right? I was in banking 20-something years before I joined Liquid. And my point of reference here is the SWIFT network. So SWIFT certainly has its problems, but it's actually been around since the mid-70s, so 45-something years, give or take. And it's worked, right? Despite its flaws, it's actually worked to really enable a massive expansion of cross-border payments. And I think that if you look at it, the key attributes of SWIFT is there's a standardization that all of the members, or the nodes, if you will, have agreed upon to use. And obviously, it's had very good security. I don't think it's ever really been a break through the Swift network. So if you think about, if we apply that to exchanges developing their own blockchains, all of a sudden the first issue that comes up is interoperability. And if you don't have real interoperability, what you end up having is sort of these silos of different change of blockchains. And it may really limit the effectiveness because you're missing out on the network effect, right? And you kind of have the opposite of what happened with Swift. So I'm not sure that change blockchains are necessarily going to really develop and serve the growth of finance on blockchain. We'll see. I think at Liquid, we're taking a different approach where we're really focusing on developing tools for people to develop their own applications on the blockchain and making it very easy for them using common programming languages. We published some information about the testnet and some of the tool sets that we're making available for people. But I really want to not go too far into that. And I think there's going to be a lot more announcements about our own Liquid chain coming up. And so I kind of want to defer to Kai and our blockchain development team for those types of news and announcements.
Yeah, as you say, it's going to be hard trying to grow a chain. Like, we've seen like a lot of people have come out and tried to launch an Ethereum competitor, but everyone's finding it really hard to bootstrap another smart contract network to go against Ethereum.
Yeah.
So I would like to get your thoughts on exchanges conducting wash trading. You know, a lot of exchanges, they do wash trading, especially those that are not regulated. So they have no obvious downside. No one's out there to regulate. Liquid, at least in the Japanese side, being the regulated exchange, can't do wash trading because it's regulated by the FSA. But what do you think exchanges do wash trading, and what do you think the industry should do to solve this issue?
So let me speak for Liquid first. We basically have a zero tolerance policy for wash trading. I want to be clear. It's not to say that we don't have wash trading. What I'm saying is when it happens, we find out about it. We warn people. And if we see the behavior, we make it very difficult for them to continue the behavior. And that can include banning their accounts up to seizing assets if we see it happen. So I think we've made it pretty clear, and we don't really have wash trading as an issue at our exchange. Like you mentioned, as a regulated entity, we can't do wash trading because we have to give reports to the regulators about the trading activity. So we do trade surveillance, transaction monitoring, and wash trading just simply would flag too many things. So it's just not something that we can do. It's not something we're really interested in doing. I understand exchanges that do it. You know, it's a very competitive landscape and people want to sort of get attention. But I think at the end of the day, real knows real. There's lots of analytics out there, lots of great research done by like Alameda Research, for example, and many others, digital asset research, I go on, that people can look through these things and people can understand pretty quickly where volumes are not real. I do feel, you know, I do think there's an issue. I really like what you guys are doing with your liquidity measures and your trust scorings. I think it's a great value to the ecosystem, and I really appreciate what you've done, Bobby, to help the whole industry, because that helps everybody, especially players like us where we don't have wash trading. It's very much appreciated. But I do think it's unfortunate, but I also think it's not a permanent condition. That as, let's talk about Singapore, for example, because that's something where I'm spending a lot of my time on now. We're applying for the Singapore Payment Services Act, digital payment token license. And what you're starting to see is the world is getting divided, especially at the exchange space of, you know, regulated licensed exchanges versus non-regulated. And at the same time, you're starting to see more institutions, more and more when they're onboarding and they're looking for a venue, they're much more likely to send out, for instance, an RFP, and they ask questions about, well, do you monitor wash trading? Do you monitor transactions in and out of the exchange and search for blacklisted wallet addresses? And so I think naturally these problems around wash trading and false signaling will sort of attrit away at time, and we'll look back on it almost with a smile that it's just a kind of a blip in time. We don't rely on it. We don't think it's important. Frankly, I don't have the time to do it, even if I wanted to. There's many other legitimate products and services and ways to serve our clients that we want to focus on.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I think the landscape, if you start from many years ago, every exchange is non-regulated. And then Japanese FSA started by regulating exchanges. And then we start seeing many jurisdictions putting in place a regulation regime. And then things just slowly turn into a whitelisted regulated entity, and then there'll be some who try to jump from one country to another country, and then areas that they can operate will slowly decrease, and then eventually every exchange is probably going to be regulated. Maybe one or two countries will keep it unregulated, and then that's when things going to be pretty obvious which are the regulated and non-regulated one. But we should see in a few years from now. But as you said, in the long term, like everything is going to be regulated. Let's talk about derivatives, right? So you guys have two Bitcoin derivatives product, the Bitcoin CFD and the Bitcoin Perpetuals, which you guys launched recently. What's the difference between these two products, and when should a trader trade the CFD and when should a trader trade the perpetual?
Yeah, sure. It's a great question. So I think the main difference is around the funding and the swap rates. So a CFD is paying a fee every 8 hours, and it's got a fixed interest rate where people, when you open the position, you know what the funding rate's going to be, whether you're paying or not. And with the perpetual swap product, the difference is the funding rate is variable and it can switch over time, and it's accruing, you know, every second, and you could be paying or receiving, and then we calculate total financing fee at the end of the period. So it really depends on what your trading strategy is. It also may depend on if the perpetual swap is trading at a premium or a discount to spot. You could either pick up the funding fees or you might be paying. So it depends on, you know, what kind of strategy you're implementing. I would say for a trader that's willing to just take a position, a leverage position for a period of time, probably something like the CFD or the Infinity product is a better way to go. For traders that are looking for basis trades, where maybe they're going long the spot trade and they see that there's a big funding available for shorts and they want to get the carry, that's the option that they might pick. So it really depends on trading strategy, which product suits you better.
In the perpetual, like the trader has a chance of receiving the funding, but in CFD, the funding all goes to liquid, right? If I read it
correctly. That's right. And that's great. Thank you for mentioning that. That's another key point, is that on the perpetual swap, liquid is not receiving or paying the swap. It's always one-to-one between the payer and the receiver, the two market participants. So versus the CFD, we are the counterparty.
Yeah, I was reading up a lot on the differences between a CFD and a perpetual. I come to the conclusion, a perpetual is a peer-to-peer marketplace where liquid operates the marketplace. And the CFD is one where liquid is the counterparty. And as a buyer of a long or short position, you pay liquid the funding rate. So yeah, that was my understanding of the difference between the two.
Exactly.
And in Japan recently, right, so the maximum leverage that can be offered by regulated exchanges, I'm not so sure if you guys are doing it, is at this point in time, I remember it's 4x, but the Japanese FSA has stated that they want to reduce this to 2x, which is half. Yeah. And I saw that on Liquid, both CFD and Perpetual offers 100x leverage. I think this is for the non-Japanese users.
Correct.
What about in Japan? Yeah. Do you guys offer any leverage there?
Yeah, that's right. So just a little back in history, let's go just a little bit back in time. I think it might be interesting for people to understand. A lot of the initial industry in crypto was really derived from the FX industry. Japan has traditionally had one of the largest FX margin marketplaces in the world. And so that was sort of the genesis of the initial crypto trading business in Japan. And so when I first joined Liquid in 2017, I actually think leverage at that time could go up to 25x. And the FSA is following a playbook that we've already seen in the FX markets here in the crypto markets by over time reducing the amount of leverage that is available for people. And again, the main idea here is to basically protect consumers, sometimes protecting them from themselves. And we think that's a good thing, right? In fact, we'll maybe be talking about a little bit later. One of the key metrics or KPIs that we've set ourselves up is, you know, how many liquidations or margin calls do we have on our clients? And the lower amount of liquidations and margin calls, then the better we feel like we're performing for our clients. So I think the reduction of leverage is actually a very healthy thing. It removes some of the casino type of element from the industry and focuses more on real utility for people.
It's interesting that you brought up casino, because one of the observations I've seen the past couple of years is that it feels that a lot of these exchanges are treating the crypto market as one massive casino for everyone to kind of bet and lose their money, and then the exchange makes money from that sense. I personally feel 100x leverage is too much. for any trader because it's very easy to get margin called and you have positions closed. But some people tell me that in the FX industry, people can go up to 500x leverage as well. And 100x is just a start, and then people will start offering higher and higher. And that's no problem. If someone wants to trade at 300x leverage, we should allow them to trade 300x leverage. What's your thoughts on that, like for Bitcoin leverage trading up to
300x? So, you know, I think about sustainability, right? And I think we think about two things. Number one, sustainability. And as a business and as a, you know, serving our clients, if we are, in a sense, blowing up our clients, we're not serving our clients and we're not even serving ourselves. So we want to create tools and a venue that's sustainable where clients can continue to use us for various services relating to crypto without them all burning themselves up, right? So one of the things that we focused on in a recent release is including better risk management tools and calculators. Where they can see real time what their margin capacity is. We tell them, you know, we give them a risk calculator and lets them sort of do a scenario analysis about what different prices would mean in terms of their margin availability. We give them warnings if they're putting in an order and they don't really have much margin available, that they might be liquidated in, you know, with within, say, one standard deviation of the price. So we've tried to do a lot around investor protection to mitigate the risk of them basically blowing themselves up, right? And we think that's an important part of our job as a venue.
What Liquid's plans for 2020 and beyond? Like, I'm sure you guys have a lot of plans. If you can disclose some of the interesting things that's happening, like, that would be good to hear.
Mm-hmm. So I think the first part is I just want to talk about what we've done the first half of 2020. So I became COO in November of last year. And after the winter break, I came back and I really started thinking about KPIs. And that's been a big focus for our teams, not only our product teams, but our operations teams, our client support teams. And we think that that's been really successful for us to improve our overall ability to serve our clients and improve the service levels at Liquid. So the things that the types of measurements that we look at that we've been constantly improving upon are things like our liquidity levels, depth of the order book, the amount of balance breaks that might be available that are interfering with clients' activities, and the amount of time it takes for them to, say, open up an account. And so that's been really successful. It's put us on sort of a mindset of constant improvement. In Japanese, there's the word Kaizen.
Yep.
You know, very happily see floating around all of our internal presentation decks. As I look into the second half of 2020, I think we're starting to focus more externally on how we're better able to serve our clients. And one big initiative, before I get into the product side, just more about our mindset internally, we're developing a metric called the social trust scoring. And what this is five key metrics that most impact our clients. And we bundle these five metrics into an index, and we can track that index over time to see how we're doing as an institution serving our clients. And the five indicators that go into our social trust score are, number one, the number of liquidations. So we take 2019, for all these metrics, we take 2019 as our benchmark. And then we judge our success. Say if it's a scoring of a 1 to 10, we would take 2019 and make that our baseline as a 5. And then as we reduce the number of, let's say, a liquidation, which we would say was an adverse outcome, our score would start going up from a 5 to a 6 and onwards up to a 10. So the key indicators, like I said, number one is liquidations. Number two is what we call our service level for asset transfers. And that's an index about the time it takes for people to make a deposit, to make a withdrawal. And we look at all of the times in our rich data depository, and we can come up with a metric and really see what we're doing over time, if it's improving how we're serving our clients. The third factor that goes into the social trust score is the amount of slippage on limit orders. So we've certainly developed a lot around stop loss orders and limit orders, but it's also important for us to understand that how many of those orders get executed exactly at their limit price. Another key indicator that we look at a lot for the big traders is the amount of latency we have for each execution. So we know what our baseline is for 2019, and now we're trying to bring those number of milliseconds down. And that's an important part of how we establish trust with our user base. And then finally, an interesting one that's kind of more aligned to the new products we're rolling out is how many new people are we bringing into the crypto ecosystem? And we're really focused on businesses. And what I mean by businesses is businesses that are accepting crypto as a payment, businesses that are using point of sale systems where Liquid is providing some back-end infrastructure, and wallets, and how much growth those wallets can provide in terms of liquidity, where they're, again, they're using Liquid as a back-end infrastructure provider. So that's kind of part of how we think we can contribute to building out the ecosystem and also developing trust among our users and the broader community.
I think these are very interesting metrics that you guys have. And it's quite rare to hear that liquidation is one of the core metrics for you guys, because obviously when clients get liquidated, you guys get more money, but you guys think long term. And that's obviously good for the consumer. So the other four metrics are also very interesting to see how you guys think about the direction of Liquid in the future. So it's been a good time talking to you. But one last question before we wrap up. If someone's interested to learn more or to trade at Liquid, where's the best place to follow and learn more?
Oh, gosh. I would probably say that one of the best places to look is at liquid.com. We have a blog site where we're publishing a lot of information about new products and features that we're rolling out and new token listings that we're doing. Today, I published a blog post about what we're doing to improve our wallet infrastructure and our security based on some recent attacks that we've seen where data loss happened at some other exchanges. So we published some information about that, both in English and in Japanese. So I would go there. The other thing that we're trying to do, again, sort of a secondary metric around our social trust scoring is around, we're trying to get our management team much more involved in Twitter. I myself am on Twitter. I've tried to set a KPI of about 3 tweets a week where we're talking about different things we're doing at Liquid. And some of my colleagues on the product side and on the business development side are also tweeting out about what we're doing, as well as we'll be tweeting out about what we're doing on the cash development side as well. So I would say the blog posts and Twitter are probably the easiest places to consume information about what we're up to at Liquid.
Yeah, it's right. I mean, I'm going to start following you on Twitter right now. It takes time and it's hard to spend time on Twitter. Like when you guys are and we're busy working or something on the computer, like it's just hard to spend time on Twitter, but it's something that you guys have to do because the crypto community, as you all know, is on Twitter. So yeah, Seth, thank you very much for taking the time to have this podcast with us at CoinGecko. We really enjoy and learn a lot from this conversation. Yeah, I just want to say thanks for your time.
And thank you, Bobby. And if you don't mind, I just had one question for you.
Yeah, sure.
So what do you think CoinGecko can do to best help develop a blockchain ecosystem?
Yeah, so I think for us, like the way we look at things is that the blockchain ecosystem is highly complex. I have trouble explaining it to my parents, and the basics is hard enough, and the pace of development is moving so fast that if you don't have the basic, it just gets harder and harder to know all the things that's going around. So when I got started in Bitcoin, like 2013, I just have to understand Bitcoin as a base layer. But if someone were to come into Bitcoin today, they have to understand Bitcoin, the Lightning Network, and the scalability issue, and then all the forks on Bitcoin. There's Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin SV, and then the history that goes on behind it. So just understanding Bitcoin as a whole is just complex. And I see how it's hard. Like every time we onboard someone new over here, we have to train them and guide them on some of the reading materials. So for us over here, I think our role is to really try to help educate the market. And for us, emphasis will be on crypto education. How can we take all these things and digest them into an easy manner for people to really understand things? I think back when it started, there was no Ethereum. Now there's Ethereum. Ethereum is a whole ecosystem by itself and it's grown onto many different ways. And then there's DeFi, decentralized finance. And then there's DeFi has grown onto whole different things as well. So one of the first initiatives that we've done was in publishing a book on decentralized finance. So we published a book called How to DeFi. We wanted a guide, but the guide turned out, as you write more, we turned out into a 200-page book, 25,000 words. Now we put it out and that's been well received by the crypto, the Ethereum community at least. And I think for us, it would be something like the DeFi book, but for many other sectors in the crypto space and like for Bitcoin, for the others. Like for example, you can imagine a How to Bitcoin book, for example, that explains Bitcoin, Lightning Network, Liquid Network in a non-technical manner that is easy for someone who doesn't know much to read up and to know how to get started. Like for example, setting up a wallet and so on. So those are the things that we do, education on like books. Maybe we start doing some other things. Because at the end of the day, like, there's only so much that we can do with the community that we have to really make crypto go to its next level. We have to get people who are not in crypto at this point in time to really understand, to start using. Otherwise, we will never be able to grow this industry.
Yeah. Absolutely. Where I see you guys really helping the industry is, I'm wondering if you have some metrics to align this, where exchanges have better scorings, you see that there's more people visiting their page on CoinGecko. And if you're starting to see a correlation where their trust scores go higher, that they have more clicks. And I'd really be interested to see if you guys have been able to track that over time. But I, for one, certainly appreciate what you guys are doing to help promote good behavior, transparency among the exchanges, and looking forward to working with you on helping to build this entire ecosystem.
Yeah, we do our best. It's a cat and mouse game. I think we were the first in the space to say that this can't go on anymore. Like this wash trading is getting too ridiculous. All these kind of weird exchanges appearing at the top. We came to a point where we said that trading volume is no longer a good indicator as for exchanges liquidity. I know it's not a case for regulated exchanges, but back then, most exchanges are non-regulated, so it's no longer a good indicator. So we have to look into the order book metrics to see which one has, like, I'm interested when you said slippage was a key criteria in your social trust score. Not many people look at slippage as a metric, and for us, that's quite a good indicator. If I want to sell $100,000 or $1 million of Bitcoin or some of the altcoins, like, yeah, if it slips like 20-30%, like, that's obviously not a good trade for any trader. So
that's right.
That's something that we want to look at more closely to see how we can measure it in a more accurate manner.
Great.
Okay, great. Great talking to you. Thank you very much to come on the CoinGecko podcast.
Thank you, Bobby.
All right, that wraps up the show. Thank you for listening to the CoinGecko podcast with Bobby. If you like our show and want to know more, check out podcast.coingecko.com or please leave us a review on iTunes. If you have any feedback, do drop us an email at hello@coingecko.com. Join us for more next week. See ya!
This podcast is provided as part of the overall information on cryptocurrency contained on our website, is for your general information only, and does not howsoever constitute any endorsement, financial or investment advice, nor any solicitation or offer of securities or other financial instruments. CoinGecko and the podcast presenter makes no warranties, implied or express, of any kind in relation to this podcast, including, without limitation, the accuracy and updatedness of its content. All opinions and recommendations there in the podcast are based on the personal opinion of the presenter. Please conduct your own research and procure professional advice should you, at your own risk, decide to howsoever invest or trade in relation to the content contained in the podcast.